This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show. Let's do this Chris Herney deal. Chris Herney joins me now. Chris, what are you listening to?
It's We'll Sweep Out the Ashes in the Morning. Graham Parsons with Andrew Harris. Graham Parsons, born on this day in 1936, passed away in 1973.
We're getting a little bit of a dicey, we'll try this again, connection. Are you still having Jeffrey? No, we're going to try it again. Yeah, very quickly he was breaking up, and so I would just as soon have pure, unadulterated Chris for this segment, and so we're trying to get Chris back on and hope for a better connection when we get him back. His piece, by the way, about the difference between this year and last year, and the way the Grizzlies have started, is up now, and I have tweeted it out. All right, Chris. So the Grizzlies lose last night, and I was telling Jeffrey, you know, given the cast that they're playing with and given the Zach Edey breakout game, it wasn't a loss that particularly depressed me. I felt okay about it. How'd you feel about last night?
Yeah, I think less so than a couple of the others. You know, they're on the road against a team that's not supposed to be good, but is actually playing pretty well. And you had a terrible shooting night. And so I think the first thing you'd point to is you just can't, it's hard to shoot from three that like that and win a basketball game. And so it would have been nicer to get the Zach Edey game and the John Morant highlights and a win, but you know, that's how it goes.
Yeah. And get to Zach Edey here in a minute. It's as you pointed out, they are, I mean, and in your piece, so they're starting two rookies, and then they got two other players in the rotation who are elevated off of two ways. And what you had last night was both Jalen Wells and Santi Aldama couldn't shoot. I mean, they didn't shoot particularly well generally, but those two were duds. I think all of 11 combined from three. And you just don't expect a playoff contender to be starting a second-round pick. I mean, you know, I don't know how much you can put on Jalen Wells.
Yeah, I mean, starting one rookie is part of the plan. So I don't take anything away from that. The idea is to be a really good team starting Zach Edey.
Right.
The idea is not to be starting and playing 33 minutes for Jalen Wells. I talked a little bit about it on the show yesterday. I wrote about in the piece that went up today. They are giving more minutes to players lower on the depth chart in the start to this season than they did to the start to last season, in which everything went off the rails. And given that, those players at the bottom of the depth chart are performing, I think, pretty well, and the team is muddling through pretty well, considering all that. But you can turn that around. They've played a pretty weak schedule, especially when you consider, you know, the disarray of Milwaukee and Philadelphia games they won.
Right.
And they are underperforming their, in terms of record, they are underperforming their actual level of play. The Grizzlies' point differential in the season is not much worse than Phoenix. Phoenix is 6-1. The Grizzlies are 4-4. The difference is Phoenix is winning close games. The Grizzlies are losing close games. And they are losing close games, including last night, in the context of not being willing to give their star players the kind of minutes other teams give their star players in close games. You know, you can debate the wisdom of that. It might end up being the right decision. But that is the reality of their situation. No one complained about it last night because 30 minutes is a magical number. But they played John Morant and Jaren Jackson less than three guys for the Nets.
Right. Yeah. Continuing theme. It also felt like last night just missing shots was such a key part of it. But you're exactly right. I mean, part of one of the, I don't know the stat exactly, but when Ja is on the floor, they are dramatically outplaying the other team, right? I don't know what the...
Yeah, they're plus 14 per 100 possessions. I remember this because I updated it in the column I wrote, but they're plus 14 per 100 possessions when John Morant plays.
I guess my question is this. Until some, you know, a large wave of reinforcements comes back, should this be much better than a 500 team? You know, as long as you're starting Jalen Wells and playing the, as you point, deep bench guys, the heavy minutes that you are?
Maybe not. It's fair to say it shouldn't be much more than a 500 team, but the reality is you've played the games and it could be better than a 500
right.
team. I think you have to take the reality of the games as they come. I tend to think they should have leaned in a little bit more in tight games to try to secure some of these wins instead of playing the long game.
Right.
But they have a history of playing the long game and succeeding as well. I mean, Taylor Chicken seems to have a history of starting slow and really getting hot in December and January. And I think the hope would be that not going as deep into minutes with star players early will be to their benefit long term, and that you will be a healthier team, you know, a month from now than you are now, and that you really catch your stride. The West is not, you got three teams off strong starts. But in terms of, like, if your goal is to be in the top six, I think that's the real goal. Like, it's not running away from you, that's for sure.
And then it was interesting. Jaron mentioned, Drew Hill was there at the game, and Jaron mentioned their trouble with dynamic guards who get downhill. You know, whatever. Schroeder was great again last night. It's also, you got a second-round pick, and Ja Morant are your perimeter, you know, defenders there. That's not a strength. Of that.
No, and that's going to be, Zach Edey was much better last night, but you're basically playing drop defense with a huge center.
Right.
And so that is going to be susceptible, you know, to guards getting in the lane, right? And so, yeah, but I also think that, like, you know, those kind of guards tend to have success in the NBA right now, too.
Right.
Like, I think those guards are hard for, like, anybody to cover. Like, you know, you got one yourself that's hard for guys to cover, you know?
That's true. All right, onward to Zach Edey's game, which was obviously statistically fabulous, but impressive to watch unfold. 25 points, 12 rebounds, 4 blocks. What'd you think?
You could see in the first 3 minutes, and there was no guarantee it was going to continue in terms of production, but you could see in the first 3 minutes that he just seemed much more comfortable playing, like, aggressive, forceful basketball around the basket on both ends of the floor than he had at any other point in the regular season. And it wasn't surprising to see. We'd sort of been, I think, been waiting for to see something like that. Like, he may not go 11 for 12 again, like,
right.
ever, but that's not going to be the last 20 and 10 with multiple blocks games he has. It won't be, like, an every night occurrence, but, like, that's not going to be a fluke. Like, he's going to have other games like that. And it's clear, given his size and given his touch and everything else, like, he can be a force in the paint on both ends of the floor. To be that more consistently, I think it's just a matter of getting comfortable, you know, and getting reps. And so I think it was great to see him have a breakout game like that.
I don't know what your thought was coming into the, I've forgotten, I know you were high on Zach Edey, but did you think, to the extent there are struggles, they have largely been on the defensive side? I mean, he looked honestly uncomfortable offensively too early on, just because he was adjusting to the speed or something, a comfort level. But he's very clearly finding his way. Rebounds and points seem to be coming. What do you think of his progression on the defensive side?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's had struggles and growing pains on both ends of the floor. I don't think he's found a rhythm on offense other than dunking the ball. And I think he is a better, you saw in the preseason where he started slow, and then he had a couple of games where he was just really dynamic as a post player. I think it's harder for him to get consistent touches in regular season basketball. And without consistent touches, it's hard to build a rhythm. So I think it's been a little bit more of a challenge for him.
Right.
I think defensively is always going to be the bigger question with him. And you're always going to have to account for him. Like, he has strengths as a 7'5" dude around the basket.
Right.
But he also has weaknesses in terms of his foot speed. You have to sort of scheme for that and account for that with teammates. And, like, you know, defense is a team situation. It's a team sport, but good defense is about team, not about individual for the most part. And so the challenge is incorporating Zach Edey's relative strengths and weaknesses into a team context that offers good team defense. And I think, you know, it's rare for rookies to be good defenders right out of the gate anyway.
Right.
And so I think, you know, he will never fully mitigate his foot speed issues, but being able to recognize things better and react quicker and feel more comfortable with the speed and size and everything the players around him, I think that comfort level, everything other than the foot speed, I think will get better over time, and it will mitigate whatever is remaining in terms of his foot speed issues, which will never fully go away.
Okay, Grizzlies next have the Lakers, and the Lakers, obviously, you know, the big question now is AD going to play? Injured his foot last night. Lakers got off to a rollicking start, certainly less so recently on this road trip, including last night's L. Thoughts on the Lakers?
Yeah, I think that team is very shallow. I think the Grizzlies with all their absences can't really press the depth advantage they could if both teams were at full strength. So maybe, you know, that's a wash at this point given the Grizzlies. But I think of course 82 games, the Grizzlies have vastly superior depth. I think it's gonna help them in terms of not competing on Wednesday night, competing in a playoff race. I don't know if LeBron James is still a great player, but this may be the season that it takes a little half step back as a night in, night out, you know, situation. I think they need Anthony Davis to be their best player, which he has been. And he was dominant out of the gate, but now you've had this injury thing pop up.
Right.
And the question with him is always, how many games are you going to get, and how many games are you going to get at that MVP level? I think if he plays and he can be himself, like, you know, it may have been good for Zach Edey to get the one game confidence boost in before Anthony Davis takes it all back away. But I mean, let's hope maybe Anthony Davis needs to rest that foot. He should call Luke Kennard. Luke Kennard would tell him that you really need weeks to rest that sore foot.
Caution is the word. In terms of your piece, and I've tweeted it out today, you go through fairly extensive evaluation of what all the players lower in the pecking order, what they've done and how they've contributed. A couple things, and I'll let people read them that for their own, but a couple things stood out that I wanted to ask you about. One was Scottie Pippen Jr. When you he has been very good, obviously, but the word of caution that you sounded is that he has not been particularly good when he is the only point guard, or the team has not performed well when he's the only
right.
point guard and not there with Ja. What have you
that's
seen?
The key. It's not that he is not good. It's that the team performance. If you look at the lineup data, you isolate Scottie Pippen on the floor, Ja Morant off the floor. Those are the only two point guards on the roster other than Yuki Kamara, right? And so that gives you everything where Scottie Pippen is operated as the sole point guard in the lineup.
Yep.
The team performance has not been good. Now, again, that's a small sample. I think it runs counter to what you see in terms of Scottie Pippen's individual play. So I don't cite that to say, aha, the team is not good with Scottie Pippen as the point guard. I cite that only to say the team has not been to this point good with Scottie Pippen as the point guard. That may not be the case going forward. So I don't think the team should change what it does based on that data yet. But I do think it's something to keep an eye on, especially as more options come on board.
Your note of caution with Jay Hoff is simply that this shooting is unsustainable, right?
Yeah, but I think he will still be good. I think he's a good shooter, but he's a good shooter at like a 40% level, not at a 55% level, right? I know no one shoots 55% with a lot of attempts from three-point range.
And then finally, we talked about this yesterday, Jalen Wells entering the chat, and you write about them all together. They've now got Vince Williams, Gigi Jackson, and Jalen Wells. And they're all different, and they all have promise, and they all have, you know, what. I'm just curious, how do you think right now they would, like, where do you rank them in terms of importance to the Grizzlies over the next 5 years? And, like, right now, NBA dispersal draft, what's the order of selection?
I think Jalen Wells is third on both of those. If you assume health, right?
Right.
And so for this season, to me, Vince Williams is number one. I think Vince Williams is the best player right now if they're all healthy, and I think G.J. Jackson's the best prospect. And so I would put Wells third in both of those two different lists. But to me, he has entered the conversation, right? He's at least on the list.
Right.
Whereas I think before the season started, he wouldn't have been on the list.
And you can actually imagine a world where he could surpass one or the other. I mean, who knows how careers go? But like, if he is a legit,
sure.
Yeah, he's obviously the purest shooter of the three,
and you can trust him on defense. And yeah, but there's the other thing here, like we're sort of pitting them against each other to some degree because only one could be a starter between Bane and Jaren. But like, there's going to be plenty of room for all three of them to get minutes and to be part of the team.
Right. All right, Chris. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Chris Harrington from the Daily Memphian. Anthony Davis, by the way, I'll be clear. Some people, Jeffrey, like to see the best players play.
Not us.
I like to see when they play the Grizzlies, I like to see the best players sit. And if Anthony Davis sits Wednesday, that would be a grand thing. Here are his lines for this year. 36-16-4, 35-8-4, 31-9-2, 29-15-3, 22-13-2, 38-11-2, 37-9-4.
And he is one guy that really gives Jaren problems.
And he destroys Jaren. Absolutely. He is one guy,
that
gives Jaren problems. So rest up. You know, I don't even think he needs to make the trip.
Listen,
just go home, consult your,
what's one of the number one physical concerns for bigs?
Your foot?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
You can never be too cautious.
All right. We got Fish on Friday, on Tuesday, coming up next. But first, I will tell you, we got a Thursday night football game, Bengals and Ravens. And over at FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook, new customers, $150 in bonus bets if their first $5 bet wins. I got to say, the Derrick Henry story is ridiculous. He's about to turn 31. He's going to finish with 1,900 yards. He's leading the league in rushing. He's leading the league in yards after contact. It's ridiculous. So I'm going to just go ahead and in your same game parlay, give him a touchdown, anytime touchdown, or over rushing yards, or whatever. Joe Burrow's dealing, though, too, and against that Bengals secondary, against that Ravens secondary, Joe Burrow over 1.5 passing touchdowns. You can assemble a same-game parlay of your own over at FanDuel. And again, if you're new customers, $150 in bonus bets if your first $5 bet wins. Just got to go to FanDuel.com/Calkins, C-A-L-K-I-N-S, C-A-L-K-I-N-S. Must be 21 or older and present Tennessee. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call Tennessee Redline 1-800-889-9789. Night. Fish on Friday, on Tuesday. When we return, Jeff Calkins Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. All right, back on the Jeff Calkins Show, joined now by Charles Fishman, our man in Washington, D.C. Charles is the author of 3 New York Times bestsellers, most recently One Giant Leap, The Extraordinary Story of Ordinary Americans Who Took Us to the Moon. Also a 3-time winner of the Gerald Loeb Award for Excellence in Business Writing, and a retired Mississippi River tugboat deckhand. And it so happens, Charles, that I got a text today from a librarian in Memphis, and the librarian said that Thursday, a man came up to my desk on the second floor of the Central Library and basically asked for any books by an author named Charles Fishman. I said I was quite familiar with said author, because he listens to your radio appearances, and knew we had several of his titles and proceeded to look for them in the catalog. He did find the story, the book you wrote with Brian Grazer, the Curiosity book. The only copies of the Moon book were in the Bartlett branch, which is no longer in the system. It's left the Memphis library system. But then the Big Thirst, it had been lost since 2021. And he had to put out.
I'm sorry, all they had was the Curiosity book?
No.
Oh, God.
And then the Big Thirst they had, the water book, but it had been lost since 2021. But because this person put in the request, they have found it. So that's good news. And it's nice that people are walking into the library in Memphis and asking for Fishman books.
That is very nice. Very, very nice.
So anyway, we have a big day today, Charles, and I don't, you know, we're not going to get into the politics of it, but and you haven't sent me a list of things to talk about.
I voted this morning.
Uh-huh.
I voted this morning with my beloved bride, and we voted in a new place that we'd never voted before,
mm-hmm.
Which was fun. A local private high school, Catholic high school. So the crucifix was on the wall. That was good. I just want to say one thing about this election.
Go ahead.
Actually, I want to say many things. But the one thing I want to say is the Electoral College is stupid, and it is time to get rid of it. We need a constitutional amendment.
I can see that
Democrats and Republicans could agree on.
They can't agree on it. I'll tell you why. Because there have been more proposals introduced to change the Electoral College than any other part of the Constitution. More than 700 times, there have been attempts to change it.
Wait a minute, you did research on it.
And it would require a vote 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states.
And 3/4
of the states. And the truth of the matter is, it's never going to happen because someone will always feel like it will benefit the other party. Right now, Republicans would absolutely feel that, listen, that all of a sudden California would matter a hell of a lot more, and Republicans don't want California to matter a hell of a lot more. We have a situation in this country where 4 times, 1824 is kind of up for grabs. Some people count 1824, some people don't for various complicated reasons. Very clearly in 1876, 1888, 2000, and 2016, the person who got fewer actual votes did win the election.
Who got the most votes did not become president.
Did not become president.
And every other
country has gotten rid of the system. The problem is that we made our Constitution much harder to amend than almost anybody else, than the others.
Most people. Right.
And so,
which has served us well generally.
Yeah. Here's the other thing that's outrageous about the Electoral College, and people don't know this, that may not know this, but it came up with it for a couple of reasons. One is to give, you know, it's based on the number of senators you have and the number of representatives you have. That's the number, okay? And so if you're Montana, you get more than you actually should get according to the people. The other reason, the real reason they came up with it in the first place, though, the biggest reason is that slaves couldn't vote back then. So that, like,
women couldn't vote either.
So slaves didn't get any, slaves didn't benefit Mississippi or Virginia or whatever, because they had a hell of a lot of them, but they didn't get to count them for the purposes of, they can't actually vote. But what they did count for was 3/5, amazingly, 3/5 of every slave counted towards how many representatives they would have. And so slaves could still count into the how many representatives we have. And so this was a way for the southern states to benefit from slavery, even while denying, of course, slaves the right to vote. And so that's the biggest reason, if you go back and look at the original documents, that's the biggest reason that we have the Electoral College, is because you needed the southern states to agree. And the southern states wanted to be able to count slaves.
Right.
So it's outrageous.
Yesterday, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris spent the whole day in Pennsylvania. And I think Donald Trump had a rally one other place. Pennsylvania has 13 million people, not even 13 million voters, 13 million people. So maybe it has 10 million potential voters we've already had 83 million people vote already. So it just gives places that aren't necessarily representative of the country this huge outside impact. And also, we're a country of winners. That's what we are. We're a country of winners. We like winners, except when we hate winners, like the Patriots and the Chiefs, except then. And And the person who gets the most votes should win.
The person who gets the most votes.
It's just a simple.
No, you're exactly right. That's the other problem. Anyway. It's a combination of the winner take all system of it means that my vote in Tennessee. What if most people's vote in America doesn't matter because it's 93%
of people in D.C. will vote for Kamala Harris. So whether we voted in the presidential part of today's election, it's just it's going
in
the total.
If you're a Republican in D.C., your vote doesn't matter, and it should. Right. It should matter. If you're a Republican
there
in D.C.
There are only seven battleground states now. It's silly. Okay, let's move. We've fixed that.
We've fixed that, but I also agree it is totally impossible to solve. It will never be solved. So go ahead. We don't agree on the likelihood.
83 million people have voted. Last time in 2020, there were 155 million total votes. The number of votes goes up every year, which is nice, mostly because the population increases. This is supposed to be a big turnout year. So we've already got at least half the number of people who voted last time, more than half, have already voted. 45 million early voters voted in person. So their votes are recorded in a digital format somewhere. Even if you voted on paper, that vote's been scanned in. 38 million people voted by mail, including half the people in this family. Both our kids have D.C. as their residence, but they aren't here because they're in school. One reason it's not fraud for it to take till midnight or until Wednesday or until Thursday to count the votes is, just as an example, our kids' ballots are in a sealed envelope. In the envelope, they're in another envelope. The signature has to be verified. The piece of paper has to be taken out and then scanned. That takes a lot of time when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of envelopes, right? And in some states, they are forbidden. They are forbidden by law to start working on those until the polls close. Right, we don't start counting until everybody's voted, which makes a lot of sense. But that means there are people furiously ripping open envelopes, you know, in Pennsylvania all night long. That's not a sign of incompetence or slowness or fraud. It just takes time. So, there's been a bunch of great stories about when we'll know things. You alluded to this. The polls in America tonight close at 9 different times. Starting at 7 p.m. Eastern, as you said, but I think you left out Alaska. Alaska's polls close at 1 o'clock in the morning Eastern time. And Georgia, swing state, closes in the first wave at 7. North Carolina, another swing state.
So 6 Eastern. North Carolina is at 6:30.
Right, 6 o'clock Memphis time. North Carolina, 6:30 Memphis time. Pennsylvania closes at 7 Memphis time. Then at 8 Memphis time, a big wave, including Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin. Nevada is the swing state that closes, and Iowa, right. And then Nevada is the swing state that closes last at 9 o'clock your time. But half the ballots in most of those states were cast early. And so you don't close the polls and then instantly know what's going on. And so by most measures, given how close this election appears to be, we won't know anything tonight. You can go to sleep at midnight secure that you
won't know. I did read a piece that suggested that Georgia and North Carolina, and I'm not steeped in this, I think maybe they do allow people early votes to be counted early, and a lot of votes came in early.
If the
theory there was
Georgia and North Carolina, we might know them.
If they go for Trump, then you're like, okay, well, this is going to be a long election because we're going to have to see what happens in Wisconsin and Michigan and whatever and Pennsylvania.
Right.
If they early on go for Harris, which would be an upset, then you're like, oh, well, we may not be, you know, either way, we aren't going to know tonight. But you might get some early indication looking at Georgia and North Carolina.
Based on how they go, if they go toward Harris. Pennsylvania is the biggie, and we may not know Pennsylvania tonight.
Both campaigns think
Pennsylvania has so many electoral votes that it's a pivot. it's very hard for Kamala Harris to win without Pennsylvania. Possible, but then she has to win all the other battleground states. Anyway, we have a long tradition of ballot initiatives in this in this segment.
Right.
41 states and the District of Columbia are allowing us voters to make policy at this election. The big things are abortion, marijuana, minimum wage, and then one state's voting on its flag.
Maine. Maine is voting on its flag.
Let's save the fun one for the end.
Yeah.
Abortion is on the ballot in 10 states. Since Roe was overturned in 2022, seven states have voted on abortion. In all seven of those elections, voters protected abortion rights. They didn't protect the restrictions. They lifted the restrictions. Tonight, 10 more states vote. Five of those are voting in states where abortion is either banned or very seriously restricted: Florida, Missouri, Nebraska, Arizona, and South Dakota. And one of those, in Arizona, it appears the measure will protect abortion rights will pass. Florida requires 60% vote to approve all ballot initiatives. It's not clear that the abortion measure is going to get 60%. It will get, it's polling at 57%, which is a lot, but not enough. And then apparently Missouri, Nebraska, and South Dakota, too close to call. Marijuana on the ballot in three states today.
To make it basically Dakota, legal, to make it legal, Florida, recreational marijuana legal in all three places.
Right. Marijuana is legal in 24 states. Mama Fishman voted no on marijuana in Florida. She said, and I quote, "It makes people act kind of crazy." So
there's some wisdom in that. There's some. When you go to Michigan now, the billboards, there are the weed billboards, unbelievable. It's just remarkable. Do you realize, by the way,
right there in Traverse City?
I was
right there in Traverse City.
The Dank, what's it called?
Is a marijuana.
The Dank.
No, the House of Dank.
The House of Dank,
right in downtown.
The House of
Dank. Anyway, North Dakota and South Dakota have complicated histories.
I learned that I was listening to one reason that marijuana is called marijuana, as opposed to, you know, it's got lots of other names it could be called. They named it, opponents to marijuana picked this ominous sounding, foreign sounding name because they wanted to make it feel ominous. That's why marijuana is called marijuana. It was a marketing to try to label it something.
It was an anti-marijuana.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that interesting? Right. Okay.
Anyway, North and South Dakota. Yes.
Two other things we want to talk about. The flag is one, but the minimum wage is on the ballot. This is remarkable. The minimum wage is on the ballot in three states. 24 times the minimum wage has been on state ballots since 1988, always to raise it.
Yep.
What do you think the batting record of the minimum wage with voters is? Do they vote?
I'm heavily in favor of raising
since 1988. What do you think the batting average is, the win-loss on 24 minimum wage rises?
I'm going to guess it's 19 and 5.
Are you there?
I'm here. I don't know why you can't hear
me. I've lost you.
Well, you can't hear me.
Can anybody hear me?
We can hear you just fine. We can hear
Am
you
I
just
coming
fine.
In or not?
100%. We can hear you.
We're having a major technical difficulty on the radio.
We can hear you. Call him back. Call him back.
I'm going to hang up.
Call him back. Charles doesn't realize we could hear him all along. My bet on the, you people now can play this game at home. My bet on the ballot initiatives is that 19, it's been on the ballot 24 times, minimum wage. I'm going to wager that 19 times it has been raised. I think people are generous of spirit. There are some who are like, let employers set the minimum wage wherever they want. I think overwhelmingly people have voted to raise the minimum wage, but we'll find out shortly. I appreciate Charles's dislike of the Electoral College. I just don't think it's going to change. And so that's why I wasn't particularly on board with that. Charles, we could hear you all along. We could
hear
you.
That was the worst major technical difficulty we've had in 4 years.
Well, something was happening because we could hear you the entire time.
I was just sitting here holding my phone. The minimum wage.
Yeah, I guess 19 and 4. 19 and 5.
19 and 5. 24 out of 24. Voters have always approved a minimum wage increase. On the ballot in California, $18 an hour. Alaska and Missouri at $15 an hour. California's $18 an hour may not pass. Alaska and Missouri, big campaigns on behalf, no opposition, expected to pass. That's kind of interesting, 24 out of 24. And yes, Maine is voting on its state flag. And this is what a thing to put on the ballot. The current state flag features the state seal, which has a picture of a sailor and a picture of a farmer. And Mainers, some Mainers want to switch to the traditional tree. I guess it's a pine tree.
And a star.
With a star.
It's a much prettier. It's a much prettier flag.
It's a much more beautiful. Florida has the state seal. State seals are terrible. State flag. It's just not. But there's been a rallying on behalf of the tradition in Maine of farmers and fishermen, and that thing looks like it's going to go down to defeat. Watch for the Maine state flag initiative.
Right. People will be on the edge. That's why all of America has a stomach.
Maine polls close early, so we should know. Get to my favorite item now.
Okay,
I didn't even send you a list.
Go ahead. No, you didn't.
What's my favorite item?
The centipede.
The millipede. Oh my God! Big news this week from the world of paleontology and insectology.
Oh. Uh-huh.
The largest millipede in the history of the world. We all know what a millipede looks like. It's about the, you know.
I don't really know what a millipede is. I'm familiar with a centipede.
A pretty big millipede centipede, about as big as sort of the end of your, you know, your index finger from the knuckle out, you know.
Yeah.
But thin, lots of little legs. The millipede that is getting attention in the fossil world this week is 9 feet long. Weighs 100 pounds and has 22 legs on each side, a leg every 6 inches. Oh my God!
Lots of things. I do think, had we existed in the world alongside the dinosaurs when this era and the millipedes, it would have been freaky. You know, Can you imagine a 9 foot millipede coming at you? How did they discover the millipede? Who found the millipede?
Well, the millipede was first discovered. I was thinking exactly the same thing. What an astonishing thing to discover a millipede that was 9 feet long. In 1854, and here's what they discovered. Here's all they had discovered until very recently. They discovered the skin of these, which was shed during molting. So they didn't know what the head looked like because the head wasn't included in the skin. And it's called, let's identify it, Arthropleura, a 9 foot long millipede. Now they've discovered some babies that were complete, and the babies had heads with a jaw that chewed vegetable matter, leaves and twigs, plant debris. So the millipede wasn't coming for you.
Right.
It was just, unless you had a plant, it was just eating plants. And it had eyes on stalks like a crab, which they considered quite unusual for this kind of creature. And they also, they talk about why it was so big. In that era, sort of 300 to 500 million years ago, there was 50% more oxygen in the atmosphere of Earth than there is now. Oxygen content of the air was 30%. It's 21% now. And they think this was the era when dragonflies had a 2 foot wingspan. Imagine encountering a dragonfly.
What's the oxygen relate to here? How does that?
The oxygen helped creatures get bigger because they didn't have to work as hard to get the oxygen they needed to grow, because there was so much. The oxygen helped them thrive larger and larger. A centipede sort of had, centipedes and millipedes get their oxygen through tiny little holes in their shell, and with oxygen concentration, it could get.
I love the millipede story, but I really love the Ruby Tuesday story. Is it Ruby Tuesday or is it Chili's or is it which story? Before we go, I wanted to get to that story.
TGI Fridays declared bankruptcy on Saturday. Friday or Saturday.
TGI Fridays.
TGI Fridays. TGI Fridays at one point had 600 restaurants in America. They are down to 95 now, 39 company owned and 56 franchised. That's not many TGI Fridays, 95.
One of the points that someone you were reading was making was this was of a style of restaurant that we once populated, roamed the earth, like the millipede.
Well, we loved them. We loved it. It was like the era. TGI Fridays, we picked them off. TGI Fridays, Ruby Tuesday. Ruby Tuesday, by the way, has been bankrupt. Chili's and Applebee's. This is Jonathan Mays, who's the editor of Restaurant News Magazine. Really good guy. Follow him on Twitter, Jonathan, M-A-Z-E. Fascinating, fascinating plunge into the world of restaurant. I mean, he said, you know, they were all the same. They had gregarious service, you know, cheery wait staff. Kitsch on the walls. I love that.
He included O'Charlie's, too. Kitsch on the walls.
O'Charlie's, right.
Drinks,
O'Charlie's. Kitsch on the walls. They all
drinks.
Decorated the same way from an antique store. Reasonable prices, you know, pretty similar menu, and a very busy bar. Not a sort of old-fashioned, dark, smoky Irish bar, but a bar you stop in on the way home from your marketing job, you know.
And now they've all gone away, basically.
And three out of five are bankrupt. Chili's is the one that's thriving. I don't know why Chili's is thriving in particular compared to the others. But, you know, there's been this whole new world, which is Panera
and Chipotle.
The quick, they call those QSR, quick service restaurants, that provide food that's a little better, a little more elaborate, a little more customized.
Is it better?
Burger King.
It's more customized.
Oh, yes.
But it's not better than Ruby Tuesdays.
No. But it fits our sort of grab and go style, and
you
frankly,
have to sit down and wait for a server to come and whatever else.
And they're undistinguished from each other, ladies and gentlemen. If you're hesitating, go vote.
We didn't get to the backpack story. Save it. We didn't get to the backpack story. Save it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the founder of Home Depot died this morning. Imagine creating a hardware store the size of Walmart and saying this is going to succeed. That's what he did. He changed the hardware and home fix-it business. Bernie Marcus.
Thanks, Charles. Appreciate it.
Also a big Trump supporter.
On Twitter, at C. Fishman.
Have a good election.
Yeah. There you go. Oh, I got to tell you, by the way, if you're looking for a new financial institution, we love Leaders Credit Union, Claire and I. We went to the London Bartlett. There's a new location in Arlington. And the technology is fabulous because it's a credit union. Technology is fabulous. Rates are fabulous. Service is fabulous. They're involved in the community. It's kind of a financial institution you can feel good about, not just because you know you're getting a great technology, great deal, all of that, but because they are. I keep getting press releases about more good things they are doing in the community, recently giving money to local schools. It's Leaders Credit Union. To learn more, go to leaderscu.com/ESPN. Jeffrey, what's coming up next on 92.9?
Jason Fitz and Jessica Benson will join Jason and John today. Tim Murray joins us on Jeffrey Wright and Company. Jeff will be with Gabe at 5 o'clock.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We got to get out of here. Back tomorrow. For now, work is done.